time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello, welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. This is our show for Memorial Day weekend 2019, and while I did get my voice back and would really like to thank Greg Pretty for pitching in last week, I'm really not up to par to do a great job editing the three wonderful interviews that were waiting for this week's show. As such, I am going to offer you up the encore of Memorial Day 2018 show. The show begins with fellow podcaster and Leadville 100 guru, Eldon Nelson. Then it's a discussion of Joe Mungo Reed's book, We Begin the Ascent. And finally, it's an encore of an encore with F.K. Day from SRAM and World Bicycle Relief. I promise we'll be back next week with a brand new show, with an interview with Steve Rex, frame builder out of Sacramento, and a couple of really interesting ladies who work in advocacy, one in D.C. and one right here in Ohio. I hope you have a wonderful Memorial Day weekend. I hope you stay safe. Here is our encore presentation from May of 2018. This week I have two great new interviews and an encore conversation from way back in 2010. You know, Brian and I talk about the show a lot, as you can well imagine, and he suggested that newer listeners may not travel back into the archives to ferret out some of the over 1,500 interviews stored on the blog. So first up this week is Eldon Nelson. We have spoken with Eldon in the past, but he's just launched a brand new project, and I think it's a very interesting one. Eldon has raced the Leadville 100 mountain bike event 21 times. He has finished it 20 times, one of only 8 people in the U.S. to do so. I would suggest that Eldon is an expert on the subject. So the Leadville 100 podcast was launched on Wednesday, and it's already getting a lot of attention. Podcasts will cover all aspects of the event, and, well, let's let him tell you, because it's a fascinating subject, and the way he's going about it is really interesting. After a short break, we'll talk with Joe Mungo Reed about his new book, We Begin Our Ascent. Now, I don't read a lot of fiction, but I was hooked on the first page. This book won't even be available until June 19th, but I was lucky enough to get a pre-press copy, and I really enjoyed it. The book is about a rider in the Tour de France, though the race is not actually named in the book, and his wife, who is a brilliant scientist. The two characters, Saul and Liz, are beautifully developed, as are all those in the supporting cast, including the team star Fabrice, the soigneur, better known as the Butcher, and especially the director sportif, Raphael. Joe and I will flesh out more of the story in our conversation. After we take another short break, we'll replay my 2010 conversation with F.K. Day. He's the president of SRAM. I go way back with the company to a time when they were just testing the waters of the industry in the mid-80s, and so have seen the growth of not only their components, but also their commitment to their amazing charity, World Bicycle Relief. FK and I talk all about it. I hope you'll enjoy the show. It's our final episode for May. So let's head on out to talk with Eldon Nelson about the Leadville 100 podcast. Hi, Eldon. Welcome back to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me, fellow podcaster.
Oh, it's so good to be back. How are you doing, Diane?
I'm doing really well. Thank you for asking. We haven't caught up in a long time, and you are going to launch a new project, so I wanted to jump right into it.
So, I appreciate you plugging me.
Well, what the heck? I mean, you know, we have to help each other here, fellow podcasters, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, my new project is called the Leadville Podcast, and it's a podcast that is for people who are interested in or are racing or have considered racing and want to try to get into the Leadville 100 mountain bike race, which is the highest mountain bike, one-day mountain bike race in America, also known as one of the hardest.
Okay. Well, I knew it was one of the hardest, but I didn't realize it was one of the highest. So define highest.
The lowest point of the race is 9,500 feet. The highest point is 12,600 feet, and it's the altitude that really makes it a tough race. If you put the course at sea level, it wouldn't be such a big issue.
Right, right. Well, I don't breathe well much above sea level, so I can imagine. I can imagine. So tell people exactly where Leadville is in the state.
Okay, so it's in Lake County, Colorado. The closest metropolitan area would be Denver. It is up above Vail. It would be another easy way to say it. But it is a mining town that is just way up there. And it is a beautiful town. It for a long time was an out-of-work mining town. And now it is really well known for this mountain bike race as well as for the running version of the Leadville 100. And then there are other Leadville-based mountain biking and running races as well.
Well, I know that you have done this race quite a few times, over 20?
I have started 21 times and finished 20. So
and your
one
wife,
time I one your time wa- I crashed out.
Oh, well, you know, stuff happens. But your wife also does this race too, right?
That's right. Lisa has done the race, I think, 13 times, possibly even more. And actually, her daughter and son have each done it as well. So between the four of us, we have 40 finishes.
One of the questions I have is, what is so compelling about this race that you would repeat it so many times? I can understand repeating something like Ragbri because it's like, you know, you get to go ride with 8,000 of your best friends. But this is a grueling race. It's only, you know, only you have to cross the finish line by yourself. You're not like this isn't a team event.
No, no, it is definitely not a team event. Most mountain biking events are not. But I think it is the fact that it is so grueling that has been so attractive to me, that it is not something that you ever just sort of figure out and feel like you have nailed. For the first 15 years I did this race, I had an objective of finishing it in under 9 hours, and I just couldn't do it. So after my 15th try, when I finally did finish under 9 hours, which is one of the main objectives that people have, I was just thrilled. And I had to, you know, from then on, it's been, you know, trying to be faster and faster and faster. It never gets old. And there is a bigger crowd for this race than most mountain bike races and certainly amateurs. And the area, the feel of the town, everything. And kind of like what you say about the whole Ragbri thing, there is a real sense of family. And especially after you've been going so long, it feels like a family reunion every year.
Who actually puts this race on? Who organizes this Leadville 100?
Lifetime Fitness owns the race at this point. They bought it from Ken Klober, who was the founder of this and the running version of the race. And Ken remains pretty heavily involved.
Yeah. When is it?
It is the second Saturday of every August. And
so
this year,
up?
I think that makes it the 11th.
Wow. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Eldon Nelson. He used to have – do you do the Fat Cyclist podcast anymore?
No. When I shuttered the Fat Cyclist blog, I also closed down the FattyCast podcast
okay.
as well. But I've been doing other podcasts and just always kind of interested in a – you know, whatever the next interesting project is. And it finally occurred to me that if there is one thing – in the cycling world that I'm actually an expert on, it is this race. And since it is so difficult to get in and so many people are interested in it, and I have done it enough times that I have the course memorized, it's the one thing that I probably can speak to with authority.
That's a good thing. Wait a minute. So
yeah.
Why is it hard to get into? How do you qualify for the race?
It is extremely difficult to get in. You can get in by lottery, And while Lifetime doesn't disclose how many people apply, the sort of the scuttlebutt is that as many as 10,000 people apply each year, of which around 1,500 get in. And so it's difficult to get in just that way. And then there are a number of people who qualify in as well. And it is – you have to be fast at one of their qualifier races to get in. I'm lucky enough that I kind of grandfathered my way in. I got in back when you could just mail in your registration, and they still let folks like me in.
Are you going to do the race again this year?
Of course.
Stupid. I am.
Well, I wondered if maybe you were going to just back off and podcast it as it was happening, which would be kind of interesting, just another way to look at the event. But if you're, you know, I mean, you're not going to give up your number 21 race here, right?
I actually am not, and this might be the most difficult year ever. This isn't something that I have talked about a lot, but another race that I am a huge fan of is the Breck Epic in Breckenridge, Colorado, and put on by Mike McCormack. That is a six-day mountain bike stage race, and Lisa and I are doing that. And then the following day is the Leadville 100. So we will be doing 7 days straight of racing and the final day being Leadville.
You're just a sucker for punishment, Eldon. What the heck is wrong with you? So tell us a little bit about what
– This is fun.
Yeah, this is what we call fun. Right. Uh-huh.
Right.
So tell us a little bit about what you're going to be talking about on the podcast. So I know it's not just you, even though you could probably speak to whoever's listening for – a long time about what you've learned and the bike and the clothes and all of the and how to eat and all of that. And I'm sure all that's going to be discussed. But who else is going to be on your podcast with you?
My co-host is Michael Houghton, and he has the best voice in cycling, a real radio pro. So I'm super happy to have him on board. Rebecca Rush, the Queen of Pain, has a Questions for the Queen segment.
Good.
And so very lucky to have her on it. And then Coach Jonathan Lee, who is one of the hosts of the Trainer Road Ask a Cycling Coach podcast, is also going to be on each episode for a training tips with Jonathan Lee. So we've got an amazing amount of expertise and me.
So obviously you have some sponsors then already.
Oh yeah, I've been very lucky with sponsors. Shimano is sponsoring, Envy is sponsoring, Banjo Brothers Cycling Bags is sponsoring, and The Feed is also sponsoring. So we have we have an ad in between each segment, which is a pretty nice thing for a brand new podcast.
Oh yeah, that's excellent. You know, I've never gone out and done a lot of that soliciting for sponsorship, and you know, I envy that you have done this. I think it's awesome. Well, I should say, yes. I'm envious. I'm not jealous. I'm envious that you're doing that.
Right.
But I think it's awesome. So how often will you be doing your podcast?
Oh, that's the thing about this one. So I released six episodes on the first day that the podcast came out. And those are just me recapping stories from years past, as well as a sixth episode, which was a really good interview I did with the race founder, Ken Klober. We're now doing the weekly episodes, which will go up into and through the race itself. So we have 15 episodes planned for season one, as well as the six episodes that came that we're calling our season zero season.
Nice.
After that, we will have to see. I kind of think that we will go quiet until at least November after the race. And at that point, we might start talking about how to get into the race, how to start planning early in the off season for the race and so forth. It is something that requires a lot of work and a lot of focus to do well at. And people plan their whole year around this race. And so next year, we may have a podcast that runs from November all the way through August. Or we may say, hey, the 15 episodes we did were good enough. We'll have to see.
Okay.
We're playing it loose.
Okay. So we're in the end of May right now. And if people have been sort of training for the Leadville, and I do want to talk about the buckle, but not yet.
Sure.
I mean, we need to – you can't talk about Leadville and not talk about that. I'm wondering what kinds of advice or things you're telling people between now and race day. What kinds of things are you telling people they should do or shouldn't do? And are you also talking about equipment?
We are talking about equipment. We are talking about everything. I actually, for the first time ever in my podcasting life, have a 15-episode content calendar planned out because I wanted to have, you know, there's so much I wanted to talk about. I really had to focus this to get everything in there. So each episode has a segment on the course. We have a feature, questions, of course, with the queen and the training tips. The feature, the first episode was, can you finish this thing? And has advice on how to set your mind and get your body ready for finishing this. The next episode that's coming out is going to be all about food and drink. Then I'm talking to a doctor in the following one to talk about altitude and how to prepare for and cope with that. And it just goes on and on. There's so much you have to know to do great at this race. And that's really what this podcast is about, getting people ready and hyped and excited for a race that I love.
Obviously, the enthusiasm is like nonstop here. All right, let's talk about let's talk about beside the glory of finishing this race.
Okay.
Talk about this magic buckle. What is it?
Okay. There are a lot of different buckles. So if you finish it's pretty fun actually. So if you can finish the race under 12 hours, which means you have an official finish, you get a cool silver rodeo style belt buckle, and it's about the size of a small rodeo belt buckle. If you can finish under 9 hours, then you get a much larger buckle. And that was the thing that I was in pursuit of for 15 years and was just over the moon when I finally got. If you do the race 10 times, you get a personalized buckle with your name embossed in it, and it is a coveted object. And then there are eight people in the whole world who have the 2,000-mile buckle. And that is something that is about the size of a dinner plate, to be honest.
So,
it is too big to wear. It is way more of a mantelpiece trophy, but it is still buckle-shaped.
So interesting. Do you know who came up with the idea of a buckle?
I would guess that I would assume that it was Ken Clover as a rodeo style guy. And I know that he actually took up bull riding when he was 60 years old. But as someone who likes rodeo and as a person from that part of the country where rodeo is very popular, I can see how that idea would have come about. And I've seen buckles on for other races, and I don't know who started it, but I do know the Leadville belt buckle is something that you are real proud to have and wear when you are in town for the race.
That is true. I have seen pictures of them. I have heard people talk about them. And you are probably the only person I know who actually has. I'm wondering if that's true. There must be a client of mine that has one, but I can't think of who it might be. That's really cool. Oh, it might be Zach. Zach might be the one guy here who would have a Leadville 100 buckle. Anyway, so tell my listeners how they can latch on to your podcast. Where is it? Repeat the name of it. And then you can get on with your training or whatever you're doing right now.
Well, thanks so much. So to find the Leadville podcast, just head on over to Apple Podcasts and search on the word Leadville. We are lucky enough to be the top result for that already, amazingly, after 2 days of existence on this. There just aren't that many podcasts about Leadville, I think. You can also go to Leadville100podcast.com and find it that way.
So wait a minute. It's only been available for 2 days and I nailed you today? How cool is that?
When you messaged me over Facebook yesterday, that was launch day. So yes, you are right there with breaking Leadville 100 news.
Wow, I feel so fortunate. That is so cool. Well, Eldon, I wish you a lot of luck with the podcast. I don't think you're going to need it. It's obvious that you've got it under control. This is a subject you know everything about. So I really appreciate you taking time to talk with me and letting our listeners know about the Leadville 100 podcast. Lots of luck with it. Thanks so much.
Thanks much, Dan.
All right. You have a great day.
Eldon Nelson is the originator of the Leadville 100 podcast, as you heard in our conversation. I think it's interesting that Eldon keeps coming up with new podcast ideas. I think that's the way to stay relevant. Maybe I should take some notes. Anyway, let's take a break. And when we come back, we're going to go all the way over to Edinburgh, Scotland to speak with Joe Mungo Reid about his new book, Let's Begin Our Ascent. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. You are listening to an encore presentation of our show from Memorial Day 2018. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll continue with Joe Mungo Reid's interview from last year.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU University Heights.
Promised, here is my conversation with Joe Mungo Reid over in Edinburgh, Scotland, about his new novel, We Begin Our Ascent.
Hello, Joe. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, I guess we have to tell people kind of what happened. This is like the third time we've tried to do this interview, and hopefully this one will take. We had some technical glitches here at the John Carroll station. And when I got home and looked at the file, it was like, eh. So we decided we'd do it again. So I'm really excited because I love this book and I want people to enjoy reading it as much as I did. And I think that you have some great things to say about it. So, you know, I'm really fortunate because I get these copies. This book will not be published until June 19th. It's called We Begin Our Ascent. It is a novel, and we don't see many cycling novels. So tell us a little bit about the premise of the book.
Okay, so the book is set during the Tour de France, and its narrator is a cyclist called Sol, who's riding in the Tour de France in a team that's somewhere in the middle of the peloton. And we meet him about a third of the way into the race, and the narrative unfolds over the rest of the race, not quite to the end, but most of the rest of the race. And this narrative is also interspersed with his recollections of his past year, which includes having a son, having a child for the first time, and his relationship with his wife. And both of these threads build together into a sort of complicated web as his wife becomes involved in a certain amount of dubious assistance to the Tour de France.
Good way to put it, dubious assistance. Tell me a little bit where you came up with the idea of doing a story that is around a stage race like the Tour.
Of course. So I started this in 2012, actually, quite a long time ago. And the initial germ of the idea came from Tyler Hamilton when he was beginning to speak for the first time about his time on US Postal and in Lance Armstrong's operation there. And he revealed that the riders used to call EPO, the drug they were using, Edgar Allan Poe as a code name. And I just found that fascinating. I loved it because it was, A, such a bad code, and B, it just seemed so preposterous that they could expect their alibi to be that they'd finish a long tour stage and read some Gothic literature.
Right. It's pretty preposterous.
It is. And the fallibility of all of that, the idea that, no, these aren't sort of criminal masterminds, but in fact, young men doing things in a slightly silly way, actually sort of opened the realm to considerations of fiction, really, for me, because I could suddenly imagine, you know, it's not this slick operation. There's all sorts of room for a writer to invent a narrative around it of indecision and mistakes and humanity.
Well, there's some wonderful characters in this book, just amazing characters. Let's start with your protagonists, Sol and Liz. So Sol is not exactly, you know, he's a domestique, actually. And his wife, Liz, is sort of this brilliant geneticist, a scientist. I see that as sort of a role reversal of strong and weak in a way. And that thread goes out through the book.
Yeah, definitely it does. I mean, that was actually quite intentional that we that we have those two characters that have these different roles. And I felt that it would give a certain tension to the narrative to have Liz sort of pushing her husband on at certain points in the book and feeling a bit like perhaps she could be inhabiting his position better than he himself could. And vice versa, Sol observing his wife sort of feeling herself to be hitting a ceiling in her work where she wasn't being given credit and feeling that he maybe would have been better in that situation. So that generated some tension in the novel.
By the way, I don't mind the barking dog.
Yeah, pardon me. We've just got a puppy, so he's.
What kind?
He's a Vizsla, so he's a runner.
Okay, so
or not yet. He's not.
Vizslas are they? Where are they from?
They're from Hungary.
Hungary, actually, right?
I was in the garden yesterday, and there was a knock on the window, and one of our neighbors. Opened the window and said, "Excuse me, is your dog Hungarian? We're Hungarian."
Yeah, you know, we had a friend who had Vizslas. They're beautiful, beautiful. But yeah, they are runners. That is true. So I guess we should get back to the book. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Joe Mungo Reed. He is the author of a new novel about cycling, and it is excellent. It is a page-turner. I literally sat down and read it in Brian's shop while he was doing other things. We Begin Our Ascent is the name of the book. It will be available June 19th from Simon & Schuster. So I wanted to talk about your director sportif, Raphael. I found him a little creepy.
Yeah, well, I think that's a good thing. I mean, he's supposed to be a slightly evil character in this novel. Or maybe not evil, but he certainly does some slightly dubious things. I based Raphael on, I think, certain characters you find in professional sport. The one I'm most familiar with in the UK is Jose Mourinho, who's the manager of Manchester United. And the thing I find fascinating about him is he's a man who seems to understand the role of sport in a sort of postmodern way. He sees it's only a game, but rather than letting that diminish the importance of it, it sort of allows him to increase his manipulative abilities over everything. He sort of has a sort of sense of casting himself as a villain in order to influence the narrative. And I sort of wanted to imbue Raphael with this kind of characteristic, the idea that really not caring about whether people hate you and constantly sort of getting into their heads can actually be a real way of achieving sporting success.
He certainly was able to do that. I mean, sometimes it sounded like it was soothing. Other times it was like, you're just going to do this, you know. And evidently the riders just did what he wanted them to do. One of the most interesting characters, of course, is Fabrice. Mm-hmm. And so I want you to tell us a little bit about him. He is the star of the team. And he also does dream interpretations, which those two things just somehow were really interesting together.
Yeah. In terms of making him as a character, I started with Sol, who's the domestique, and in a sense fits that role so well, he's almost trapped by it. He can't quite summon the ambition to do anything beyond assisting others. And in Fabrice, I wanted someone who was actually a natural leader, who was sort of born to go fast on his bicycle. And so I've kind of sketched him as one of those slightly unlikely athletes who actually seems to enjoy it, even after all the years of training. The dream interpretation side of things was my wondering what kind of other interests he would have outside of bicycling. And I thought, well, you know, what's the healthiest interest it could be? And I thought, well, it'd be an interest in his sleep. So I got him wondering about dreams and learning about dreams. And it gave me an opportunity to reread The Interpretation of Dreams by Freud, which I think is always a fantastically amusing book and has some wisdom and lots of funny moments in it. So I kind of built that into the novel as well.
Another character, and I don't know how you came up with the name, was The Butcher.
Yeah.
And actually he is the
Sonia.
Oh, he is the Sonia. Yes, the butcher. Why did you come up with that?
I don't I'm probably so far from the decision, I can't quite remember, but I sort of figured that people would have nicknames. I mean, I don't know. There's an element of research here, and there's an element of me just guessing what it must be like. But I kind of wanted the sense of these characters being familiar. I assume that people aren't walking around teams calling everyone by their given birth name. So
yeah, that's interesting that they probably make up nicknames sort of to suit what their role is or the things that they do. I don't want to give away too much of the story because the ending is very, I don't know how to put it. It's not really, it's shocking and it isn't. And it's fascinating. The way you brought the story to a close is fascinating. But would you relate one of the chapters with Saul and his thoughts about why he was actually chosen to race this event? Because he probably shouldn't have.
Yeah, so at one point in the flashbacks in the novel, we have a moment of Saul doing the pre-race camp with the team, and they're doing certain tests to see whether they have the fitness and the readiness to race on the tour. And he does pretty badly on these tests and has a sort of sense that he's, you know, really on the limit of actually making the team or maybe being dropped and not racing. And then in the present section of the book, he slowly begins to find out in these dramatic later stages that perhaps the reason he's actually made the team is because Fabrice has asked for him to be on the team. He's asked the management to include Sol. And the idea here for me as a writer was to sort of underline the sense in which friendship is an important aspect of all of this. You know, writing about a close-knit team of young sporting professionals, I wanted to underline the extent to which in one sense, they are being asked to be machine-like. You know, they're literally working out how many watts these guys can output per day. But then in another sense, there's a completely ineradicable element of the sport, which is just turning around and seeing if there's a guy behind you who has your back. And so I wanted that to be felt in the book.
Yeah, it was. It definitely was. So we didn't talk about this at the top of our conversation, but I wanted to know where you became so expert at how the mechanics of the bike race. Now, I don't mean the mechanics like as in fixing bikes, but I mean yeah, you're probably as good at that, or probably better than that than I am. But how you came to know some of the nuances of cycling, because, you know, I've read about and watched bicycle racing for years, and I don't know how you got that if you're not a lifelong bike racer.
It's a mix for me. I mean, in some senses, there is invention here. I don't want people to take it as totally gospel because there is, you know, fictional license and also just some scenes I don't know about. So I've kind of filled in what I think they would be like. But behind that, there's also I did a lot of reading of cyclist biographies and I did a lot of reading of tour histories. I mean, there's excellent tour histories out there that give you a real sense of the heritage of a race like the Tour de France. And I really wanted to imbue the novel with that kind of idea of all these people who had gone before and raced these roads before. So that gave me some sense of the world I was building. And personally, also, I don't bicycle race a lot. I've raced, you know, 25-30 bicycle races, partly while writing the book to get a sense of what riding in a peloton is like. But as a teenager, I ran the 800 meters, and that was a sort of real obsession for me from between about 14 and when I went to college. I mean, I was probably training five times a week, and I mean, that's nothing like the pros do, but it gave me an idea of the monotony and the kind of what you have to submit yourself to be even slightly good at something.
Right, right. That 10,000 hour thing that Malcolm Gladwell talks
exactly.
about. Right?
Exactly.
which I think, pardon the expression, is a bunch of BS. But, you know, some people get expert faster and some people never get to be experts no matter how hard they try. And so
I agree.
Yeah,
I agree.
Yeah. So what are you working on now? This is a fabulous book, but you must have another project.
Yeah, I do. So I'm deep into my next book, or deep into a bit of research and a bit of writing for my next book, which is due to be set in the London art world and oligarchs from Russia. So it's a mix of, you know, near history about the post-Soviet era in Russia, and also art sales in London, which has a certain contemporary relevance at the moment with all these high prices and all the shenanigans going on there.
Yeah, it seems like there's shenanigans in everything, aren't there?
Yeah, I think I must be attracted to shenanigans.
Yeah, I think we all are in some way, because it certainly gets a lot of attention. So the book, again, is We Begin Our Ascent. I've been speaking with Joe Mungo Reid. He is the author. He's in Edinburgh, Scotland. We have a wonderful connection today, unlike yesterday when things didn't go so well. And the book will be out June 19th in the States. When will it be released over there? Same time?
It will be released over here on the 5th of July. So a little bit later.
We're ahead of you. Well, how nice for us. And it is the same title. Sometimes they change titles, they change covers, they do all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, they do. It's the same title. I've got two wonderful covers, but the same title in both countries.
Well, it's interesting because unlike a lot of people, I am so lucky. This one says at the bottom, Advance Uncorrected Proof, Not for Sale. I don't know if you know that. Yeah.
Yes, no, I do. I have a box of them in my house.
Well, it was very kind of Jessica, your publisher, to send it to me, and I enjoyed the book thoroughly. I wish you a lot of luck with it. And I'll be looking for your next one because your style of writing is compelling. I like it a lot.
Gosh, thank you so much.
All right.
It was a real pleasure. Talk to you.
I know it's later over there in Edinburgh. Get some rest. Thanks so much for talking with me. And again, good luck with the book. Talk again.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Joe Mungo Reid joined me from his home in Edinburgh, Scotland. Very interesting conversation. I really enjoyed it. If you are interested in the book, you can pre-order it from all the usual suspects. It is published by Simon & Schuster. It will be available in the States June 19th. And once again, the title of the book is We Begin Our Ascent. So let's take another short break. And when we come back, we'll play our encore conversation with F.K. Day from November of 2010. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We're back, and here is my conversation with the president of SRAM Corporation, F.K. Day, from 2010. Good evening, F.K. How are you?
Just great, Diane.
SRAM is a big name in our business. How did you get into, and how did the Day family get into the bicycle business?
Well, it has been a long time, and we smack our palms against our forehead all the time and say, wow, what a journey that's been, or this is. Well, back 25 years ago, my brother Stan had this idea that he got while he was touring on a bike up in Nova Scotia, camping with a couple of cousins. And he was on an overloaded bike with all his camping gear, and he always had to reach down to his down tube to shift gears. And he came back from that ride, and he said, gosh, F.K., we got to figure out how to put the gear shifter up on the handlebars of the bikes. And that's where the initial grip shift came from. So it's not that we had been in the industry for any length of time. I was doing some casual mountain biking, and Stan was doing some casual touring and triathloning. But it came based on the thought that maybe we could do something better. And I think you remember the first grip shift on the end of drop handlebars.
I do, because they were specific, as I remember, to the derailleur. So if you had a Suntour derailleur, you needed a grip shift that would shift Suntour. If you had Shimano, it was specific to Shimano. So I absolutely do remember when grip shift first came on the market.
One of the untold stories might be about our initial business plan. And we of course, thought we had the best thing since sliced bread. So our business plan called for selling 100,000 of those units our very first year. And I think we ended up selling about 820 units total, and we probably took about half of them back. So a classic startup, I guess, but we listened very carefully to the market, and the market was very clear with what it liked and didn't like, and we evolved very quickly.
Yeah, bicycle people are very persnickety, I think is the right word, and that's what I've learned over my 37 years in the business. In fact, I remember you actually ran into a little bit of trouble with Shimano along the way.
Yeah, well, they're wonderful competitors, fierce competitors, great manufacturers and designers. So we're pleased to be serving the industry with them.
So SRAM also has gotten big enough. You actually bought a couple of companies. As I remember, you bought Sachs. Is that correct?
Yep, back in 96, I believe it was.
And now it's another group. So SRAM has turned into this big force in our, and I use the word force, I didn't even think about it, a big force in our business. Force is one of your groups, of course. If people don't understand, it's a group set that goes on a bicycle. You've got all this road stuff. I remember when my partner went up to, I guess, Colorado Springs and did your RockShox seminar or workshop.
Yep.
Yeah. Yep. And I remember they were just talking about the SRAM road groups. So how are they doing?
Extremely, extremely well. You know, we've chosen a route of simple, light, fast shifting, durable, and it seems to have found a very strong niche. And we've had some very good success in the racing sector, and very good success, quite frankly, in the more just the enthusiast riders.
Well, and that's sort of, we're going to head in the direction of your specialty, which is philanthropy, really, and you and Trek joined forces evidently in around 2005 when the tsunami hit Indonesia and came up with this idea of World Bicycle Relief. And I have a little tiny story. One of my yoga students and good customers came in to drop off her money from our food bank fundraiser this evening. And she said, "Oh, who's on the show?" And I said, "Well, Mr. F.K. Day from SRAM and World Bicycle Relief." She said, "I just bought a bicycle through them." So one of my customers just bought one of your WBR bikes.
Fantastic.
She's putting it on Facebook so that other people know about it. Why don't you explain World Bicycle Relief?
Well, it wasn't any big plan that we get into this type of work, but right after the Indian Ocean tsunami, we at SRAM looked at ourselves and said, well, what can we do here to help? Well, we can raise money and give it to the Red Cross or something like that, but maybe there's a way that we can really leverage our expertise and help in a much greater way. So it was funny because I called all of the relief organizations in the U.S. and I said, what would you think if we did a large-scale bicycle program for you? And they all kind of said, no, just send us money. But we thought, well, that's really odd because we know the infrastructure has been destroyed and people have been displaced. And in these developing countries, you know, transportation is critical. So my wife, who's a professional photographer, and I flew to Indonesia and Sri Lanka and began to interview relief organizations on the ground. And the story there was completely different. You know, they said, what? You can do a large-scale bicycle program? Well, the impact would be, you know, huge. And how do you really do that? And that's something we know how to do. So that's what began the program.
So how do you do that?
Well, our original thought was let's collect up all the secondhand bikes we can find in the U.S. and ship them over. But once we got over there, it was crystal clear that there is nothing that we use in the U.S. or Europe would survive over there. And there are no spare parts over there, and our bikes are too complicated, and they have no carrying capacity. So we thought that, okay, what we've got to do is understand what they're accustomed to using and build off of the local infrastructure of bicycling. So we found in Sri Lanka, we found a small producer that was actually building bikes exactly for this heavy-duty utility market. And we worked very closely with them and sourced 24,400 bikes, men's, women's, and children's.
In what period of time?
It was about a year and a half total from start to finish.
Wow.
And what was funny, and this is what we did not expect, we thought if we demonstrate the impact of bicycles in relief effort, then everyone would figure it out and we could go back to, you know, designing components for racing bikes and Tour de France stuff.
Yeah. That's not what happened, huh?
No. Halfway through that program in Sri Lanka, a large relief organization came to me and said, you know, FK, the work you guys do here is really good, and it's clear the bikes have a huge impact. But did you realize that the same number of people that died in the tsunami die every 2 weeks in Africa, silently and relentlessly? And you've got to bring this program to Africa and show us how to do it there. So that's where this plan went from being a, let's do this, let's execute it, let's show people how to do it, to, well, we better go and develop this model of operations and prove this model out in Africa.
I want to take a moment to remind you that we are speaking with FK Day from SRAM Corporation about his World Bicycle Relief work that he's doing in Indonesia and Africa. So you probably know Craig Kalfi. Yes, FK?
I do.
Okay. He's doing a very small scale sort of version of what you're doing with bamboo in Ghana. These are steel bicycles, I take it.
The ones we use are steel.
Okay. And you have an interesting model of how you get the bicycle to the person who's actually going to be using it, the end user. How does that work?
Well, what we do, instead of us coming in with a, you know, brand new bicycle that people aren't accustomed to, what we do is when we go into a new country, we get a clear understanding of what is the spare parts availability, what are they accustomed to using, you know, what is really the voice of the end user. And then we build off of that model, and then we source the parts from, typically it's India and China and Taiwan. And we bring the parts in and set up assembly facilities in whatever the host countries are, and we assemble them right there and provide them right there. And that, quite frankly, is people say, wow, it's great you're providing jobs, but the most important part is that it allows us to control the quality of the bike, and it cuts our costs by setting up assembly facilities in the host countries.
Well, and these bicycles are utilitarian. So for those of us who are weight weenies and thinking about our 15, 16, 17-pound bicycles, these are heavy bikes that are meant to do a lot of work and save a lot of time, I understand.
Yeah, correct. We call them 55 pounds of love, but they are the single-speed steel war horses that are designed to be, you know, beaten up and repaired with a rock and carry very heavy loads and with very little maintenance last for a very long time.
Was it your story that I read about the young boy who was taking care of his family and this allowed him to go to school, one of these bicycles?
Yeah,
yeah, that was one of the most touching stories.
Well, that took place in Zimbabwe, where we also have an assembly facility. And interestingly, Nicholas Kristof, the writer for the New York Times, was hiking incognito in Zimbabwe, and he stumbled upon this young boy who was the head of a household. This is very normal, where the parents have died, and you'll have a young boy that's basically taking care of his younger siblings. And he was walking literally 15 kilometers to school every day and at the same time taking care of his kids and trying to stay in school. So Nicholas Kristof stumbled into this guy, and he was talking to him through an interpreter. And the last thing he asked him is, you know, young man, what would be the single most important thing I could do for you? And the boy said, I need a bicycle to get to school and take care of my siblings. And that's when we came in and designed a program that we were actually doing at large scale in Zambia. And we ran a program in support of this young boy whose name is Abel and several schools in his neighborhood. And the results have been outstanding.
Well, it was just a beautifully written story, and it touched my heart. And when I learned of that, I think I must have had five people say to me, you need to get FK Day on the program. So that's what prompted the original call to you. And, you know, obviously you are doing some amazing work. So how many countries now have the program?
Well, we've done work in probably maybe 8 to 10 countries, but we have active assembly facilities in Kenya, Zambia, and Zimbabwe. And we're just beginning in South Africa also.
And where else do you hope to expand the program?
Well, we get calls all the time to set up programs in lots of different countries. And right now we're we're really good at bikes, and we're getting better and better at raising funds. But the size and speed of our program is truly dependent on funding. So, if, you know, right now we're running large-scale programs in, you know, the three countries I mentioned. Our next countries after South Africa will probably be Uganda and Malawi, and we're about to run a program in Mozambique. But we get calls from Central America, South America, Eastern Europe.
So the need is great.
Yeah.
And the program tends to work really well. So how does somebody – so, all right, how did Abel end up with one of the bicycles? Did he have to buy it? Was it given to him? How does that part of the program work?
Well, what we do is we work closely with the Ministry of Education in whatever country we're working in. So if we're doing a school program, we'd get with the Ministry of Education and we'd get with the local school boards and the communities. So if we had isolated Abel and simply provided him a bike, you know, that would have been a very difficult social thing for him to overcome within the community. So what you... What we do is we work very closely with the community and the school, and we, I think we ended up providing about 200 bicycles, actually, to several of the surrounding schools, including Abel's. And that allowed us to really turbocharge those schools, enabled a lot of these students who were, you know, desperate for transportation to get to school. And the program has been very effective. We're doing a program similar to that in Zambia right now, where we're about 10,000 bikes into it, specifically aimed at education.
How does the gender work? It's mostly young boys as opposed to girls? Or are girls getting bicycles too?
Well, at I'll start at a high level on that. And right now, the areas that we're running programs are in healthcare, economic development, and education. And in each of these areas, we provide both men's bikes and women's bikes. In the area of education, when we do a large-scale program, we bias the provision of bicycles to about 70% to the girl students compared to the boy students. And the reason for that is that the results are significantly better when you support the girl students, but you can't do that to the exclusion of boy students.
So why are the results better?
Well, men unfortunately have a pretty lousy track record of of supporting their communities. But looking at it another way is that women have an outstanding track record of you know, fulfilling their education and then turning around and supporting their families and communities.
I see.
So, but if you look at many of the cultures, not just in Africa but around the world, oftentimes the girl students are the ones disadvantaged. You know, many of the families believe that by getting the boy student through school, that's the thing you should do. But people are beginning to realize that that's not necessarily the best route to success. So we work very closely with the communities to sensitize them to the to providing for the girl students. And many of the countries are just beginning to do that right now.
That's great. If somebody wanted to support the organization, what would they do?
Well, okay, so the website is worldbicyclerelief.org. So that's all one word, World Bicycle Relief. And if you go on the website, we've got some outstanding videos of the work we've done in education and healthcare and economic development. And believe it or not, we make it as easy as possible to fund bicycles that go into these areas. And because we run an extremely efficient organization, because we're embedded within SRAM Corporation and SRAM covers many, many of our costs, the highest proportion of any money going in goes straight to putting bikes in the hands of students. And that's very satisfying because it doesn't always happen that way. But if you go on, you can purchase a bike. And that puts a bike into the field. It's a portion of a training for mechanics. We train one mechanic for every 50 bikes delivered. And we urge you to get involved, see the videos. And if you do have an urge, please come to Africa.
Oh, there's a nice invitation. I like that. All right. I want to remind you we're listening and talking to FK Day on The Outspoken Cyclist. I have one little switch that I want to ask you. I ask almost every guest who comes on who has any kind of connection to the industry on the level that you do. What direction do you see the bicycle industry going in the U.S. right now, especially in light of the midterm elections?
Well, I'm thrilled with the greater and greater attention that's being paid to cycling in the U.S., and I believe it's not simply because many of us are advocating harder for it. I believe that the politicians and the communities are beginning to see the results of having greater cycling infrastructure, and I believe that they're seeing that result in happier communities, higher real estate values, lower traffic, and you know, they're beginning to see all of the great things that those of us in the bike industry have been talking about for so many years, all the way from, you know, it's good for the climate, it's good for health, it's great for lowering traffic. People are beginning to see that, non-cyclists. So I believe that the prospects for the bicycle industry are just outstanding. We've got to keep our voice up. We've got to speak collectively about the benefits of bicyclings and then how to execute good bicycling infrastructure in the cities, and we'll see our industry begin to thrive. I would hate to be in the auto industry right now unless I was on the cutting edge of energy efficiency.
Well, people like you always give me such hope. It's wonderful. And I've been talking to a lot of people. We have somebody later from ODOT, the Ohio Department of Transportation, who also has a very hopeful message to talk about this evening, about all the money that has been spent in the state of Ohio and all the money that's on the table right now. And while some of it's going to go away, we know that certain programs aren't going to happen. Everybody's talking about grassroots. So I really appreciate hearing that. Well, I'm very excited about World Bicycle Relief. We will put something on the Outspoken Cyclist Facebook page about it. And I hope that SRAM continues to be the kind of force that it is in our industry, because you support all the things that make bicycling and bicycle dealers successful. And I think that's great.
Thank you very much, Dan. It's great to be on your show, and thank you for all the good works you do and the voice you bring to cycling.
Well, thank you. I hope you have a great holiday. And we'll check back with you in 2011. How's that?
Great.
Thanks so much, FK. You have a wonderful evening.
Thanks. All the best.
All righty. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an encore presentation of our show for Memorial Day 2018. I promise we'll be back next week with a brand new show when we feature Sacramento frame builder and multiple NABS winner, Steve Rex. I hope you have a great holiday weekend. Remember to stay safe. And if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.